Yeah, psychology 381. That's right. Here we go. Okay, so gonna be looking at learning and behavior here. some of the stuff, I mean, you've taken 281, so gosh, yeah, we're going to cover stuff like, you know, habituation, sensitization, classical conditioning, operant, right? It's like some of this should hopefully be familiar. We'll be going into a bit more some different theories and looking at some things in some more detail, whatnot. But yeah, I mean, in terms of overlap with 281, yes, there's a limited number of sort of approaches to learning theory. Operant, classical, habituation, sensitization. So, yeah, we're going to do them again, but hopefully in some different ways and some more detail and look at some more applications and things like this. So, okay. With respect to learning, biological system here. I should be careful here. There are some very recent, computer programs, software, that actually do learn as well. So perhaps, one should keep that in mind. But what traditionally the field has dealt with is the biological process of learning. So what this lets us do is learning is a means of dealing with the environment. It allows us to interact with the environment in an adaptive manner, generally, which probably enhances our survival. So learn from experience, replicate past behavior, such that you gain more repetitive outcomes, or avoid aversive consequences to past behavior. It's a way of adapting to changes in the environment, to the ever-changing environment during a lifetime. Now, the ability for learning has been evolutionarily selective for all animals learn. There are really no animals that can't learn at least relatively simple sorts of things. So in this sense, at some point, very long time ago in the evolutionary process, being able to learn was extremely adaptive. Those precursor organisms from millions and millions of years ago that were able to learn even some very simple things apparently had a real edge over those critters that couldn't, and they outcompeted them. So the ability to learn is what we call an evolutionarily selected mechanism. That being said, evolution is not going to help you learn during your lifespan. You're not going to evolve learning capacity. Wait, I'm mutating as we speak, and I suddenly understand everything about psychology 381. No. Don't go out letting yourself being bitten by radioactive spiders or something like this. It's probably not going to help you with this class, okay? issues with that. Over generations, evolution is selected for the ability to learn, but what you learn during your lifespan, that's the individual then. Oops, there we go. Definition. Okay, so learning. Learning is an enduring change in the mechanisms of behavior, I dropped a word there, I'm sorry, due to experience. Again, I was typing this up very rapidly yesterday. Okay, so an enduring change in the mechanisms of behavior due to experience. Learning is really about how something ends up being done. Behaviors, then, are the procedures and actions that are performed by an individual. Behavior, we talk about what is being done. So a behavior is sort of a what. The learning leads to how. You acquire something about how you could do a trait. Now, it's perhaps important to talk a little bit about performance of behavior. And we'll talk about this later when we get into talking about things like latent learning here. But just because a subject does not perform a behavior, we can't say that subject has not learned something. So we could, the ever classic, hey, why did a chicken cross the road, right? Well, obviously, you get to the other side. But what's going on here? Let's say we put a big bag of chicken feed on the other side of the road. Now, if we've got a hungry chicken, it's probably more likely to go across that road. It's perhaps got some motivation. Dodge traffic, the turnpike of death and get there to the bag of chicken feed. If we've just stuffed food into the chicken, you know, already before we do this, chicken takes look goes, yeah, the big bag of chicken food on the other side of the road, but you know, I'm stuffed. I don't have any particular reason to attempt death by trying to run across this road here. I'm just going to stay put. Now, if we, you know, train the chicken somehow for this, you know, train it like if you see this particular stimulus in this bag, that's a bag of chicken feet, okay? Now, in the first case, when it's hungry, it's got the motivation, so yeah, I know, there's chicken feet over there, I'm hungry, I should go get it. Oh, I see. The chicken learned something. It learned that this bag indicates there's chicken feed there, off it goes. Change in the behavior, cross the road. Second case, chicken's full. Chicken isn't hungry at all. Doesn't go across the road. Say, oh, you know, our attempt to train this chicken to recognize this bag was what had the chicken feed? Abject failure. Chickens is stupid. They can't learn about bags. Maybe. I mean, chickens may be stupid, you know. Or not. Pigs, I'm pretty sure, are fairly smart. But chickens? I don't think they're that bright. But really, it's more of a motivational issue. So what we're dealing with here is the performance. Is the behavior performed or is it not? So when we talk about performance, what we're talking about is the action or actions of an organism at a particular time. And as such, then, it's not just the learning experience that is going to determine performance, right? It's going to be all these other things as well. I've just been using this example to talk about motivational states, right? But there could be any number of other things that could influence performance as well that have nothing to do with learning. Fatigue, for example. So you can have issues dealing with behavior change that have nothing to do with learning. You know, chicken says, wow, I actually am hungry. There's all that grain on the other side. There's cars coming by, but gosh, I'm exhausted. I mean, I'm probably not going to be able to run fast enough to dodge those cars without becoming a chicken pancake. So I'm just going to stay here. I'm pooped. I'm tired. Pushing eggs out of my butt every day, that's a grueling, exhausting kind of job. Right? So fatigue can change behavior. This can change performance then. Performance of behavior can be altered due to levels of fatigue. Other thing, I mean, altered stimulus conditions. You know, how much have we changed the stimulus? Have we shifted it so much that it can't generalize or discriminate? Alteration in, we've talked about motivational states here already, but physiological states as well. That could involve things like drugs. You know, if we give the chicken some, you know, I don't know, crack or something like that. You know, we've laced its food with crack, or we've, you know, given it a quick shot of heroin or something. I don't know. I don't know what the chicken's going to do. Birds on drugs, right? This is popular back in the 70s. It's like giving drugs to spiders and seeing how they make their webs. You know, spiders on cocaine, webs all over the place. You know, spiders on morphine. It's just like very minimalistic. It's just like hanging there. Hey, you know, LSD spiders were just nuts. Anyways. Maturation. Maybe kids learn something, you know. Pretty sure my son learned early on, cookies in the jar on top of the fridge. But you know, when he's 3, he can't get to it. When he was 2, he probably knew it was there, but he wasn't quite big enough to push the chair over to sort of make the ascent, you know. But as time went on, maturation, he's able to push things around, stack things up, climb up there, get onto the top of the fridge to get the goods. A little bit of a problem we're having right now. Anyways, so maturational effects. Evolutionary adaptation. Again, I mean, this is the long-term stuff. It's not going to affect something in an individual, but I mean, if you're looking across species, okay, you do the same sort of situation, same experimental controls and design, but in one species you get, you know, performance of behavior, and another you don't. Well, could be because there's just different evolutionary adaptations in the different species. They're actually perhaps not perceiving the stimuli the same way or something like that. All right. Now, in terms of looking at the looking at learning and behavior, so the study of learning and behavior, there's a variety of different approaches that have been adopted over the years. Probably the original one was actually what's come to be called the comparative psychology school of thought. This is sort of the traditional psychology of learning and behavior approach with like Watson and Pavlov and Skinner and whatnot. The idea of comparative psychology was to use models to understand human behavior. So a lot of the non-human subjects that have been used, Pavlov's dogs, Skinner's pigeons, Thorndike's rats, Tolman's cats in the puzzle boxes. It's not because these individuals were actually interested in rats and cats and pigeons and dogs per se. They were just using these as models for the human situation. So they're looking to understand human behavior by using non-human models there. A newer field, a relatively new field, is called comparative cognition. Comparative cognicists sort of, I mean, the field comes out of the comparative psychology, but comparative, it's sort of an intersection as well as some biology and whatnot. Comparative cognicists actually are interested in learning and behavior in all kinds of species. So comparative cognicists will study pigeons and rats and honeybees and octopuses and mongooses and cows, hummingbirds, whatnot, to see how they learn to behave, because they actually are interested in, one, those individual species, but two, the similarities and differences between the species. And what does that tell us about how the nervous systems then are organized to deal with these different kinds of environmental problems that these different species face? Why are some of them able to learn certain things better than others? So that was comparative. That's comparative cognition. We'll get to a little bit of this in chapter 11 of the text. Now, another old field here is ethology. Ethologists are biologists that are interested in animal behavior, so not psychologists in that sense. Whether you want to argue whether or not ethology goes back before comparative psychology or not is a little bit difficult. But in terms of the modern field of ethology, it's probably really in its modern form, tracing its way back to the 1920s or so. So in some ways it might be after the psychology side of things a little bit. So I said, these are biologists that study animal behavior, whatever species. In some ways, they're comparable to the comparative cognicists in that they'll study non-humans. But they're not so much interested in the differences between the species. Ethologists typically are just interested in the behavior of particular species, the particular species that they happen to study. They just find it interesting or they want to know about it, or there's some sort of application. You know, remember a few years ago, toads in Germany were getting just like run over in massive numbers on the Autobahn, and toads were being obliterated, and there was concerns about the extinction of certain species of German toads, and so some ethologists went out and started watching how toads got about and studied toad navigation and toad movement patterns and toad migration, and determined that you needed to make toad tunnels to get under busy roads, and if you had particular catchment features, the toads would quite happily hop towards these and bippity-bop down the tunnels and pop out the other side without getting run over by Porsches and Audis and things like that. Okay, so ethology. Sociobiology comes from really the 1970s. This was a sort of biological approach to behavior, but looking at how behaviors perhaps have been shaped through evolutionary mechanisms. We touch on evolutionary issues here. Psychology in general does now. But this is a bit of a broader scope for sociobiology. And finally, the last one I want to mention is behavioral ecology. Behavioral ecologists, again, are biologists first and foremost. They study animal behavior, including humans. So we have what's called human behavioral ecology. They study the behavior from sort of a optimization perspective. So, well, you know, you got a limited amount of resources, energy available for you. How is your behavior going to be optimized to take best advantage of these? They do a lot of mathematical modeling, computer simulations, but they also spend a lot of time out in the field. They'll actually go out and work in a naturalistic habitat and observe their subjects there as well. Whereas the comparative psychologist spends much more time in a laboratory under much more controlled controlled environmental conditions. Okay, so there's different approaches. Which is the best? Depends what you're doing. You know, no one of them is actually best. They're all different approaches, and you know, the intersection between them is actually quite interesting. Now, another thing here to consider is sort of at what level is one going to approach the study of learning and behavior. So a little sort of chart here. We got like a whole organism. So, you know, you, for example. But, so we can study your behavior. I'm studying your behavior right now. Three of you just yawned. Six of you have your heads resting on your hands. Four or five of you have computers. Six of you have computers. I'll write this up at some point. Not really. But, you know, we got whole organisms. So the whole rat in the maze, the whole pigeon in the operant chamber, what have you. Okay, so looking at the behaviors of the... We could also go in and look at this down at the sort of neuronal level. We could look at neural circuits. We could put single cell recordings in. We could sample neurotransmitter levels. We could even do this outside of the organism. We could remove some neurons, put them in a petri dish, and see what happens there as well. Grow networks of neurons, see what goes on. Or we could even take this right down to an individual neuron and the synapse. So right just down to a single, or, you know, say two neurons interacting. So there's lots of different levels here that we can do this. And each of these different levels, I mean, there's an intersection between them. Obviously, neurons and synapses, well, that's how neural circuitry works. Neural circuitry is what's involved in the behavior of the whole organism. But, you know, if you don't have a whole organism, you really don't have any neural circuits or neurotransmitters, et cetera, et cetera. You see, there's sort of a loop there. Now, each of these as well leads to a sort of a different type of learning or approach to the learning mechanism. So down at the neuron and synaptic level, we tend to look at molecular, cellular, and genetic interpretations of how the function, how these systems actually work. So things like long-term potentiation, for example, would be something you might do looking at individual neurons and their synapses. Dealing with neural circuits, neurotransmitters, larger networks of neural parts of entire parts of the brain, things that are happening there. That's much more of a sort of neural systems or neural networks interpretation. And then finally, when we're working with the whole organism, this is what we tend to refer to as the behavioral level of analysis. And this is the primary focus of comparative psychology, this course. Now, I mean, keep in mind, we will talk at points about what's happening with respect to parts of the brain or some neurotransmitters, some synaptic interactions there. But our focus is not to really go down and understand how exactly a neuron works. I'm going to talk to you about this a little bit just to make sure we're all on sort of the same page here. But really what we're most interested in is the actual behavior of the organism. Now, I mean, if you're a neuropsychologist, you'd say, yes, 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 it's all very nice that you can look at the behavior of the whole organism, but, you know, shouldn't you reduce it down to something more elemental, like how neurons interact? Well, sure, you can do that, that's fine. But tell me, if you want to, say, do behavior modification, or if you want to, say, train a helper dog, is it really all that useful to know how these three neurons are interacting in the hippocampus? Sort of the level that you want to work at. Yeah? When you look at the circuitry, can we look at more efficient ways, for example, to train organisms? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. The brain's this very complicated thing. In some cases, perhaps we can. So, I mean, we do know, for example, a fair amount about, for example, say, dopamine's role in reinforcement. And that's got some very interesting implications. I was looking at some stuff on people trying to quit addictive behaviors. And so specifically looking at this in women. And it depends their estrous cycle hormone levels influence their ability to stop, for example, smoking. So what point they are in their cycle is influenced by their overall hormonal, sex hormone cyclical fluctuations. So there is some very interesting stuff with respect to that. But again, our real focus here is you take that, you know about that, but you don't want to just change the sex hormones. You want the behavior, you want the addictive behavior, you want to be able to help someone to stop smoking. And at which point, it's not that you're going in and tinkering their hormones. From the behavioral perspective, we're trying to get people to change their behavior. Now, if that means knowing something about when you should first try quitting, depending on where you are in your monthly cycle, that's fine. But again, the ultimate aim is to change the behavior there. So, but it is important, you're right, this is what I'm saying. We'll talk about some of these a little bit as we go through here, but different courses, different areas of psychology approach this at different levels. So right, this is where, like that star coming in, you see it again? Yeah. Worked a lot on that last night. It's like, wow, this is kind of dry. I should do something graphical for this. The students will love it, yeah. It's harder to impress people with PowerPoint than it was back in 95, I'll say that. okay, so I guess there's a learning effect that's it's called being jaded. That's it. Okay, so methodology of study here. I talk about this a lot in 281, and hopefully this is just sort of a review of stuff at this point here. But we're using scientific empiricism in science. So that is gaining knowledge through experience under controlled situation. So that's what our scientific empiricism is. We don't just randomly go out and look at things. It's just basic empiricism. We actually try to control the situation to some extent. There's lots of different ways of gaining information, tenacity, just things are the way they are because that's the way they've always been. Intuition, the idea just kind of comes to you, probably because you've been processing it cognitively for some time. Authority, you accept something as a truism because someone in authority tells you that it's true and correct and accurate, like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Wait a minute. Well, okay, the authorities were wrong on that one. So, you know, one needs to critically evaluate all of this. Rationalism, using logical proofs to try to drive answers. Empiricism, just observation, but not necessarily terribly controlled. And finally, science. Or also known as the scientific empiricism. This is where we actually try to test particular hypotheses and look for particular things and try to regulate and prevent random sort of variation and biases and whatnot getting in the way from interfering with our understanding. In terms of actually, say, developing a study then, commonly we start with a hypothesis, so some sort of prediction or question there. We observe the system, we analyze the system, and we interpret it. Now, it doesn't always follow this pattern. I mean, hypothesis, observation. Sometimes we observe something, and it's just so interesting and unexpected that we actually sort of get the data first, and then we got to go back and say, now, what the heck do I think was happening there? So in some cases, a very interesting observation pops out at you. You stumble upon it, you hear about it, you encounter it, you see it, your subjects did something completely unexpected. You know, it's like, whoa, what are the rats doing? It's like it seems like they're doing some sort of cheer squad thing. They're in a little pyramid. Okay, hypothesize now. Go from there, and then go back and do more studies after that. Designs and sort of levels of constraint. So we've got sort of four kind of broad classes here: naturalistic studies, case studies, descriptive and correlational studies, and experimentation. So naturalistic, the observer, the researcher, is minimally involved. You're trying not to influence the subjects as much as possible. So ethologists, for example, are the classic example of doing naturalistic studies. You just go out and you watch your subjects in their natural habitat, right? The mating behavior of sparrows in the wild. You watch them out there. If you're doing human ethology, the mating behavior of humans in a bar. Hey, baby, listen to the male make his mating call. See what females are attracted. Jerk! They are not impressed with his dancing performance. So naturalistic. Jean Piaget was a developmental psychologist. Naturalistic observations, right? I mean, he had his lab basically redecorated to look like a very comfortable living room. You just sit there in a comfy chair, watch kids do stuff, occasionally throw them a ball, sort of thing, but really not interfere with them. It's like, there's toys over there, go ahead, play. You just sit there, take notes, I suspect sometimes it's like, I'm going to be in my lab. Don't bother me. I'm just lying on the couch sleeping. It's like, I wish I had a lab like that. So, yeah, computer games in there. I'm doing research. Right.
beer fridge. Wonderful. Anyways, case studies where you go much more in depth with maybe one or a small number of subjects. Freud. Freud's psychoanalytic theories were derived from case studies. We tend to see case studies more in medically related areas of psychology, or clinical or abnormal, these sorts of areas. You can learn a lot about the behavior of individuals by doing case studies, but you may not be necessarily getting a very representative sample of the behavior. This may not reflect the overall or general behavior of individuals well. I mean, in the case of, say, Freud, right, he bases his psychoanalytic theory around people, six women who, it seems likely, had been sexually abused as girls and young women. So his entire theory of how the human psyche works is based upon people who had suffered sexual abuse. Does this apply to people who have not suffered sexual abuse? Well, he didn't interview them because he was trying to help people, and if you're, you know, don't have psychological issues, there's no reason why you'd go to a clinical psychiatrist. Anyways, so case studies. Descriptive and correlational, very often this is just where you just got a lot of data and you just sort of describe what happened. This may be using pre-existing data sets, or it may be data just coming from questionnaires or surveys or things like that. Typically, in descriptive studies, you might make use of descriptive statistics, means, medians, standard deviations, but you typically aren't looking for, you know, power or, you know, goodness of fit or things like this, significance. It's just like, yeah, this is what we got. So is it significant? Ah, this many people voted this way. And that's just the numbers. That's what we got. Okay. Correlations. Remember with correlations, correlation is not causation. Okay. A few years back, I mentioned this story in 281. I had a student that was walking into a psychology 281 midterms downstairs, actually this building in winter, slipped on the ice outside, broke his leg, proceeded to hobble his way into the exam and write the exam, and he did terribly. Right? I mean, awful. I mean, worse than chance, as it turns out. He's got a broken leg. He's in shock. It's like, if you should be coming to an exam and you break your leg or some other part of your body, don't write the exam. All right? It's just, okay, anyways. My point here is he did very, very poorly on the exam. Now, if I was just to look at this and say, oh, well, okay, performance on the exam, correlation with intelligence, clearly he's stupid because, you know, he got like 17%. You've actually got to work to get 17%, or you've got to break your leg and be in shock. Okay? It's hard to get below chance on a multiple choice exam, right? You gotta do something for that. Okay? Now, it's a correlation. If I just look at it, if I know nothing else about the system, if I don't know that he's had this broken leg, he's in shock, writing an exam, you go, yeah, his performance clearly indicates that he is an idiot, or didn't study, or I don't know. Or he's got a broken leg at the time. Okay, so correlation, you know, the correlation between his score and what I think that means, it's non-causative. All I got is a correlation. I don't know why, right? If all I have is the numbers, I got no idea. No idea what's going on here. Okay, so correlations are not causation. Then we've got experimentation. This is where you put all your controls in place. You've been, you know, independent, dependent variables. Often you're in a much more regulated environment, so it's not just out in the natural world, these sorts of things. You're trying to test for specific things. And with experimentation, we can finally get into making causal interpretations, cause and effect. Okay, so that's the real strength, the real benefit of experimentation. But there's these trade-offs. Okay, there's a trade-off. The higher the constraint, I mean, experimentation here is very what we call a high constraint study, naturalistic case studies, and descriptive. These are generally called low constraint or lower constraint studies. Experimentation, experimental scientific experimental design, or just experiments, these are high constraint. But there's the trade-off. they may be somewhat, you know, unnatural, right? I mean, rat in an operant chamber pressing a lever. It's not usually how rats get their food, right? I mean, usually they'll, I don't know, jump into a garbage can or something, you know. Well, and if you go back before there was human garbage cans around, they were doing something else to get food. So, I mean, you know, the pressing the lever for food, that's not a typical, in some ways, environmentally relevant rat behavior there. But it lets us look specifically at things like reinforcement frequencies or contingencies. So we're doing a trade-off, right? We can make some causal statements about how the quality or the amount of the food that's available for making responses adjust the response pattern, but that may not be terribly representative of real rats in a real environment. Okay, so there are these trade-offs. Now, comparative psychology has, as I said, the point of comparative psychology was to use non-human models to understand, or when we use non-humans at least, when we're using non-human models, we're not using them to understand the rats or the pigeons or the cows or whatever it is. We're just using them as models to understand the human behavior. And so this has led to what's called the general process approach to comparative psychology or to learning behavior within psychology. There's a recognition that there is a lot of diversity across species in terms of what they can learn and what they will do in terms of behavior. And that's not seen as the point. The general process of process, let's look instead on the similarities. Let's look more at the underlying, how does one learn something? So different species may habituate to differing degrees. But how does it work? I mean, in general. So we can study different species, use them as models here to say something, okay, so what commonalities do we have in terms of habituation? What if we start doing some habituation, then we try to sensitize? What happens there? What do we see that's similar across species here? And what does that tell us then about the underlying elements that regulate the behavioral, or pardon me, the learning and behavioral mechanisms? So we're looking for the similarities across species. I mean, houseflies have a visual refresh rate of about 200 frames a second. That's why it's so darn hard to smack them with your hand. From your point of view, or pardon me, from the fly's point of view, you're moving in slow motion. And he goes, I think I should go now. Darn, almost had it. No, dude, you didn't. You really didn't. Pigeons see a visual refresh rate of about 40 frames a second. Yeah. This would be flickering to a pigeon. Things that fly tend to have a higher visual refresh rate. Right. And so, I mean, that can make things look a little bit complicated. That can look a little too, but once you sort of standardize and adjust for that, right, you know, we can do some studies in stimulus control and look for the commonalities in terms of stimulus control there. So what's similar about stimulus control across species? What does it tell us about how perhaps humans do stimulus control? Okay. And out of this then, comparative psychology has, using this general process approach, has attempted to develop rules of learning. So rules of classical conditioning. Oh, sure. Some species, it may be harder to classically condition this particular stimulus. You know, pair this stimulus with that stimulus. In others, it may be a different thing might be easier or harder, right? But the basic issue of say, you know, associating a CS with the US, that's not terribly different across species. You know, some stimuli may be easier or harder to do depending on the species, but the basic rules of classical conditioning are seemingly pretty constant cross species there. So, in a sense, this means you can then study pretty much any system or species, you know, making sure that you adjust for physiological constraints and perceptual processes and whatnot there, and then make use of very conventional experimental paradigms. So, the operant chamber, right? The rat pressing a lever, the pigeon pecking a key, or the human sitting in a small room with a computer keyboard doing things with a computer keyboard. It's all essentially the same design there, the same study design. We've scaled things up, you know, mouse in a maze,
a person, well, in the biological sciences building, and a cow in a maze. They're all mazes. Some are a little bit bigger than others. Okay? But we might change what the actual reinforcer is at the end. You know, some little chocolate chips for the mouse, you know, $20 bill for the human, a bunch of clover for the cow. But, again, there's something appetitive at the end of the maze. There we go. Okay? So, this is the general process approach there. Now, as I said, a lot of this has been done with animal, non-human animal models. Sorry, a little sloppy there. I should have said non-human animal there. We also see synthetic models out there. It's be either mechanical, so like robotics, or computational simulations as well. I suppose I should really just toss mathematical models into this as well. We'll put that in, I guess, too. So, I mean, things like the Ruskorla-Wagner is kind of a mathematical model of how things work, although it's been derived from working with human and non-human animal behavior there. A model is just a representation of reality. The point of the model is not to have exactly the same system. In fact, generally the point of a model is to have a simplified system, a system that is going to be more easily controlled, more easily regulated, more easily worked with. You may be fascinated in terms of the predatory behavior of large jungle cats, but it may be relatively difficult to study that in your laboratory. You know, as the third grad student I've lost this year, cats just keep eating them. Have you ever thought about studying this instead with, like, domestic house cats and mice? Huh. What an interesting idea. I can use a domesticated house cat as a model for my Bengal tiger. Excellent. Okay, we'll use mice as, you know, stand-in models for goats. Okay, in that sense. There you go. Lovely. Very nice. Okay. Simplifies it down. In some cases, it might be for ethical purposes. Sometimes it might just be that it's cheaper. You know, in some cases, it may just be because, ethical, I mentioned, you know, it's you know, probably unethical to get people addicted to gambling, right? But there's nothing really unethical about letting rats get chocolate M&Ms for pressing a lever a certain amount of time on a variable ratio schedule. Happy rats, they like the chocolate. It's okay. As long as you give them an otherwise fairly nutritionally balanced diet, they'll stay fairly healthy. It'll be all right. You know, as opposed to, yes, take part in the study. Become addicted to gambling. Destroy your life. Have your wife leave you. Your kids will despise you and never talk to you again. Lose your house. But it's for science. Right. Okay. So there are these considerations there. Ethics. What can we do ethically here? But here's the relevance of the features. Are you using the right species? Like I said, flying things tend to have a higher visual refresh rate. If you don't know that, you say, oh, I'm going to work with a pigeon. You know, it's funny. I don't seem to have something that works here with humans. Huh. You need to know something. You should know, you know, stuff about the models. Is it a good model? Is it a representative? Not all non-human subjects are going to be good models for human particular human behaviors. You know, pigeon might be fine for one thing you're interested in with a human, might not be good for some other aspect. So are they appropriate? So you have to know your non-human, if you will. And this is why, in fact, we tend to use things like mice, rats, pigeons, gerbils so frequently now. We've been using them for such a long time in psychology that we just know a lot about their perceptual abilities or motivational needs or dietary requirements, these sorts of things. So it's easy to control for these sorts of issues. So here's some examples dealing with spatial representation and navigational tasks in non-humans and humans. It's what's called a geometric module, discovered by Ken Chang almost 20 years ago now in rats. The rats are required to find a goal, which is a little bit of buried food hidden in a rectangular, sometimes called a maze, but it's really just a rectangular arena. Landmarks are provided. At each corner of the rectangular arena, there are very distinct, I mean, the rats can see them, okay? It's like they're huge.
landmarks. Chen used all kinds of things. Some of them were like, sometimes he'd paint the walls different colors. Other times he'd have big landmarks with lights on them. Other times he'd use olfactory cues. You name it. These are things that the rats can detect, okay? So there's landmarks that should help the rats find the goal. So here's what we've got. So, for example, here's our arena. And I'm just using these geometric symbols to represent the landmarks around each corner there. You'd put the rat down, you know, put it someplace in the middle of the cage. So bloop, put it there in the center. And then it's got to scurry around. The floor is covered in sawdust under the wood chips, buried in one of the corners, in this case here for our example. We'll just say in the corner that's got the square next to it, there's a little... again, researchers tend to use whatever is commonly at hand. What works very nice for this is the tin cans from tuna fish. You take the tuna fish out. You bleach them to get rid of the smell of the tuna and whatnot. And you put a little bit of rat chow or something down in there. And then you put some cellophane over top of this, holding on with the rubber band so they can't smell the food. And they don't smell the tuna, so it's sealed in there. But they can tear through the cellophane. So then you bury it under the wood chips. So they get over to the corner. They eventually learn if they find this, if they dig in the corner, right, they can like tear through the cellophane top here and then eat the little rat treats that are down there. So, you know, you might think, do you have to buy that, like, food system from, you know, a scientific supply house? Like, no, dude, you just need to have a few tuna fish sandwiches for the week, clean out the cans, and there's your apparatus, you know. It's kind of like going back to Thorndike when he was, like, making his puzzle boxes out of, like, crap that he was finding behind restaurants in the downtown of the city he lived in. It's like, hey, look, it's a Heinz ketchup box. I can do something with this, you know. So really, you know, we're... Despite the fact that many researchers have very high grants, you know, big grants, we're still, you know, pretty cheap at heart. I'm going to use, you know, $1.20 can of tuna. Perfect. Okay. Anyways, so that's the training. Now, in testing, what you do is you just rotate the landmarks a quarter of the way around. So notice what's happened. Our from training here, our cross here has moved from the bottom right down to the bottom left. Triangle from the bottom left to the top left, and so on. Then you put the rat back in there, and you test. Now, we won't actually put a treat in here because it's a probe trial, it's a testing trial. We don't want to actually reinforce this behavior. You just want to see where they're going to go. And it turns out that rats will go to one of these two corners. So they'll either run off to the top. In this case here. Given that in training the goal was up here, the food was hidden next to this in this corner here, they'll either run to that same corner or the other corner here. Even though the landmark is right here, you think if they were associating the food, the goal, with the landmark, they should just run up there. They don't. It turns out they use the geometry. From the rat's point of view, yeah, they can see these landmarks. They can detect them. We know that. But their brain doesn't process them in this way. What they use instead is the geometry of the environment. So if they're running towards this corner, it's a short wall on the left, long wall on their right. So that is, yeah, food is in the corner that's got a short wall on the left, long wall on the right. Well, that can either be this corner here, short to the left, long to the right, or if they're heading down to the bottom right, short on the left, long on the right. They really can't tell the difference between them. And they'll go to either one there in the testing. Now, pigeons go up here. You do the same thing with pigeons. You train the pigeon in this situation, goes and finds the goal. In the testing, we've rotated the landmarks around. Pigeons go straight for the square. I mean, in this example, it's a square, right? But that's the corner they look at. The pigeons seem to be using the landmark. What do humans do? Humans do what pigeons do. People use the landmark as well. Okay? The only time you get rats not using the geometry is if they're in a perfectly symmetric environment. So if you put them in like a square arena, then they can't use the geometry because it's like equal-sided wall to my left, equal-sided wall to my right. Ah, crap. It's like
somewhere in their brain a little switch goes. It's like, yep, that's not working. Guess we'll have to use landmarks. And then they use the visual landmarks. So, really interesting stuff. But in this case here, if you wanted to study something like this, rat, you could use a rat as a model, right? No. Rats and humans don't do this. We don't preferentially use geometric cues. We preferentially use visual landmarks. So in this case, pigeons, right? So the rats use the spatial geometry. The pigeons use the landmarks here. As I said, what do humans do? I already told you. Humans do what pigeons do. They use the landmark. Okay. So what's that saying then? Should we just use pigeons to study human behavior? Why do we bother? Why do we bother with rats? Well, as it turns out, here's another little study. So we'll scale our landmark. In training, we set this up, and basically the goal is right there in the middle of the landmark array. Straightforward. Eventually, we manage to train our subjects to dig right in the middle of these landmarks. Now, in testing, we're just going to expand. We're going to scale the array up. Pigeons will search at one of these four locations. I mean, different pigeons, okay? I mean, it seems that what happens is individual pigeons, some pigeons like squares, some prefer to use the triangle, whatever. So, but if you got enough pigeons, about a quarter of them will pick each of these landmarks sort of thing, and they'll search there. Humans, once you scale this up, will keep looking in the middle. The pigeons associate, and I've tried to represent this the same way. I didn't really measure this carefully. It's not together with PowerPoint. But, right, there's the distance between, there's the angular or linear distance between our goal and our square during training. And look, they're doing the same angle and distance between the goal and the landmark in testing. They didn't get that it's choose middle. Right? They went, pick a landmark. It's going to be this angle and this distance from the landmark. But humans go, I think it's just in the middle. The landmark array got bigger. I'm going to look in the middle. So in that sense, even pigeons here, even though they did the previous task like humans, they don't do all of the navigational tasks like humans. So it's good to know things about your non-human subjects if you're going to use them for models. And this is, in fact, some of the stuff that comparative cognicists do. This is where comparative cognition is becoming extremely useful for the traditional sort of comparative psychology, is once we're looking at these more complex kinds of traits, real-world things, which are very interesting to study, as opposed to just press a lever, get some food, right? Then it's good to know how different species do these things. So, anyways, let's take a 10-minute break at this point. And you can all rush out and buy your textbook right now? No. Okay. Come on back in 10 minutes and we'll carry on.